Let me start, though, by making some general observations about the subject matter, religion and culture, and why these are so important. It won't come as a surprise to any of us here, I think, that that there is a fundamental connection between these two, religion and culture. That doesn't mean that we're likely to agree with all the implications of the idea. Remember the saying that one person's religion is another person's magic? In other words, that what any of us believes devoutly and practices sincerely can to someone else appear as superstition or empty routine. Similarly, I may want to regard my religion as truth with a capital T, as a tradition that began in a pristine manner. I may grant that it happened in a specific context, such as during the Hellenistic and Roman centuries for Judaism and Christianity. And I could become fascinated with the details of life and strife during that period. But down deep, I feel that my religion was pure in its origin, that it resulted from revelation directly from heaven, that its laws and norms were distinctive and unique in the ancient Near East, that its rites and rituals had no precedent in practices among its neighbors. For some of us, that early religion became contaminated in the centuries that followed, and we need to recover its pristine, unadulterated form by leapfrogging over 20 centuries to get back to that early period. For others, however, these later centuries fostered the important growth of the tradition as it became interpreted and applied to new social circumstances. Actually, of course, religions, just like everything else that we know of, are heavily affected by their cultural surroundings. This whole notion of a pure, uncontaminated, unadulterated religion is a fiction. We can perhaps observe it best when we experience another religion and culture that are radically different than our own. Any of you who have traveled outside the Western world will certainly understand what I'm saying. Consider the differences between worship practices in a Hindu temple and a Christian church in the South, or between Thai Buddhist art and the Sistine Chapel, or between Japanese Shinto belief in an imperial cult with its 3 million gods and the Taliban's destruction of Buddhist statues in Afghanistan. A whole network of cultural associations stands behind each one of these. Religions cannot be isolated from their surroundings and pinned down for study as if they were curious species of butterflies. But let's not focus only on religion. Culture is similarly impacted by religion, not just religion by culture. Art and architecture the world over have sought to express religious themes and values, from the linear simplicity of the Shakers to ornate Moorish architecture or elaborate Hindu statuary. Try to imagine European art and music without religious subject matter. It's just not possible. Our beliefs, values, myths, and rituals work their way into cultural expressions, as should be expected. Often this mix is little understood by outsiders. A rather amusing example occurred in Japan several years ago when an ad agency, trying to capitalize on the power of certain well-known Western symbols during the winter season as it was developing a department store window, this ad agency constructed a large image of Santa Claus on the cross. That's true. The elements were right, but the juxtaposition jolted. Politics and economics are similarly affected when religion is injected. Think about how often we have to deal with creationism in the schools, or Ten Commandments in the courtroom. Or again, consider the missionary movements that so often sought to reshape the missionized people into cultural clones of the missionaries. If you've read Barbara Kingsolver's book, The Poisonwood Bible, you'll recognize the tragedies that can follow in the wake of a hubris that gives any one person the right to change others. There's a saying about the Christian missionaries who went to Australia, that they first fell on their knees and then on the Aborigines. Buddhism similarly spread from India through Southeast Asia, China, Korea, and Japan, affecting the local cultures while also being reshaped by each. Of course, all of this has now come to our own shores. We now have a greater mix of peoples and religions than ever before in U.S. history. Within the lifetime of our own children, all of the minority groups taken together here, along with their forms of religion, will become the majority. Somewhere between 2030 and 2050, you hear different projections. Islam currently has one of the fastest growth rates of all religions in America, and is one of the largest religions in the world. In the face of such diversity and the syncretism that inevitably follows, many religions have, not surprisingly, fallen into fundamentalist modes, preferring to view the world in a simplistic, absolutistic manner that will not tolerate difference. Again, this worldwide phenomenon is well evident in our own country as well. The most immediate example of the religion-cultural enigma is, of course, the current war in Iraq, as well as the threat of terrorism. We see here a dramatic and tragic clash between groups and peoples that scarcely appreciate, let alone understand, each other. Religion plays a key role, but not the only role, of course. It's hard for us to keep a distinction between Islam and Arabs, or between extremists and the majority of the population. Frankly, we need to remember that the people in that region can also equate the U.S. with Christianity and Judaism, and our leaders with extremism and self-interest. Both sides consider God to be backing them. Just this past Sunday, following the fragging of an American officer, and you remember that word frag, from Vietnam days, CNN, after that incident, CNN ran a clip of a Fort Campbell minister praying in church not only for the welfare of the troops, but also for our success in this just war. The reporter concluded laconically, "Here in Fort Campbell, there is no separation between church and state." When this war is over, we need to be cautious not to interpret it as the victory of good over evil, especially if we tie the good with our own religious institutions. There's a lesson from the experiences in Japan after World War II. General MacArthur denigrated Buddhism and Shintoism in comparison with Christianity, which he regarded as the solution to all of Japan's woes. He stated once, "Japan is a spiritual vacuum. If you do not fill it with Christianity, it will be filled with communism." He allowed the country to be flooded with 10 million Bibles. Didn't expect, though, that many of the pages of these Bibles would end up as cigarette paper, which was very costly on the black market at the time. I just heard yesterday that the Reverend Franklin Graham's group, Franklin Graham, you recall, is the son of Billy Graham, that his group, Samaritan's Purse, and the Southern Baptist Convention want to dispense food and medicines in Iraq along with their version of the Christian message. My first reaction was that they should look to history for lessons in the unfortunate consequences of using war as an occasion for proselytizing. Now, ever since the 1960s and 70s, the intricate interweaving of religion and culture has occupied much of the attention of scholars, not only those in the field of religion, but also those in anthropology, history, psychology, law, literature, politics, education, and more. It takes two major forms. On the one hand, there is considerable interest in the differences and distinctiveness attending to every culture and subculture in the world. We're right to be reluctant to talk about, quote, human nature, when what we see across the globe and in our own neighborhoods takes such widely diverse forms. The second type religion and culture studies focuses on common themes or problems that cut through many or all societies. Issues such as race, gender, class, health, life stages, social organization, art, economics. Throughout, attention is drawn not mainly to high culture, as it's sometimes referred to, but to all levels of society and context of human existence, without privileging the powerful, the educated, the wealthy, the well-traveled. The aim is to understand all dimensions, contradictions, problems, and players found at the intersection of religion and culture. Now let me give you an idea of how we plan to treat these materials at Vanderbilt's new Center for the Study of Religion and Culture. The center has been charged to advance the state of research in the areas of religion and culture, and in the process, to promote the scholarship of faculty and graduate students here. We will accomplish this by organizing 5 or 6 research teams to run concurrently, each for normally 3 years at a time. Each team will have 8, 9, or 10 faculty members drawn from a wide range of fields of study. They'll meet weekly or bi-weekly for discussions on their specific topic. They should bring lectures, organize meetings, sponsor at least one international conference, and publish a major book on their subject. They'll invite scholars from other universities to collaborate with them as needed, when we need the expertise and don't quite have it here. And graduate students also will be partners in these discussions. New co-taught courses will emerge as byproducts of these interactions. So we're not really setting the center up as a with a pedagogical goal as such. It's more of a research center. Their published results are not to be mere collections of papers, but should be innovative contributions that could only result from the collaboration of top scholars with a variety of specializations, combined in an effort to break new ground. We're in the very early stages of selecting the topics to study, and we've only barely begun to recruit scholars to join the discussion. So the topics I'm going to name now in a minute are only suggestive. They're not the final list that we'll have. As I mentioned each, imagine a group of researchers sitting at the same table. A historian of ancient China, a specialist in 19th century British novels, a criminologist, a biblical scholar, an anthropologist who studies Amazonian tribes, an ethicist, a researcher in human development and education, an archaeologist and art historian of classical Greece, a specialist in existentialism, and a psychologist. That's 10 scholars who probably never sat in the same room together. Think they can talk? What would happen if we give them an incentive to stay there and keep talking for 3 years on a given and specific topic? Set them loose on any of the following. It would be their choice, of course, to join. Imagine a topic on religion and terror. And I don't mean terrorism as such, but religion and terror, a topic that could draw on literature, philosophy, psychology, social psychology, religious traditions, anywhere on the globe, any place in time. So, but to deal on a focused manner on that topic of religion and terror. Or religion and slavery. It seems like an ancient institution to us. And it certainly has had some tremendous impact on American history. But it's still ongoing in parts of the world and has taken also new forms, or relatively new forms, I guess, in, for example, in Thailand with the sex slavery that's present there. Another form of slavery in the modern world. or the topic of religion, art, and aesthetics. Again, with conversation partners, not just being the people who are art historians or novelists themselves, but also people from the social sciences involved in this, and from history, from education. Or religion and the sexual self that obviously can conjure up a wide range of possibilities depending upon the people who are part of the discussion. Or something else that is seems extremely intangible but nonetheless important, religion and the meaning of life. What a variety of people do with a topic like that. Or religion and American civil life. And the next two are concrete topics that we've already done some work on. The cultural matrices or cultural contexts of Christianity. One of our colleagues here, Daniel Pott, has a project that is in process now with Cambridge University Press. It's going to be a large and influential and authoritative, probably, publication called the Cambridge Dictionary of Christianity. And the way that he has conceived this is that it will not simply be a history of Christianity or doctrine, but he's going to try to refract Christianity in terms of all of its global forms throughout the world and throughout history, just in an effort to show this diversity that comes under the term Christianity, and imagine what it is that might hold it together. He's got a team of, I think, over 100 contributors from around the world already part of this, and a good, and maybe 15 of them are here at Vanderbilt. So this is a project that, for example, could get started quite rather quickly if we approve it. Finally, another one, maybe just on the general topic of religion and culture. A very established university press, Columbia University Press, has already approached us about the possibility of producing a book for them on the theories of religion. This would not just be some 200-page reader. They've got in mind something like maybe a 700-page authoritative volume, something that would really represent. Those of you who've been involved in religious studies will know all the theories of religion that could be dealt with here, and there are other treatments of this, but what they would like to have is a volume that will represent really a new stage of the study of religion, and perhaps could become an authoritative volume that will be used by students and teachers for the next couple decades. They're thinking very ambitiously. This is the type of thing that we would like to do for all of our projects, is to try to get them in touch with publishers early on, because publishers have a very good sense about the market, about what's, you know, what the competition would be, what's needed, who are some possible contributors. In each case, we probably will go beyond simply the resources here at Vanderbilt and include a number of scholars from elsewhere, simply in order to try to broaden the discussion at points where we need it. The work of these teams will largely be conducted away from the public eye, which is probably necessary if they are to accomplish the ambitious goals we'll set for them. But we don't expect them to hide their candle under a bushel. Some events will be open to the campus and to the national community. Lectures, perhaps workshops, conferences. I fully expect that individuals in these groups will be significantly affected by their discussions and will hear their ideas in other settings as well, informal and formal. While the center does not exist explicitly to affect public policy, we're likely to become a resource for the press and the public, simply because we will be spending so much effort studying these topics, as I mean. We're living in a period when the interplay between religion and culture is as dicey as it's ever been. Religion itself can form our highest values and beliefs and ideals, but can also occasion our most tenacious conflicts. Religion and culture are embedded in each other, at times a comforting thought, and other times a frightening prospect. We need to understand better how these two domains intersect, and a new Center for the Study of Religion and Culture intends to take on that task. Thank you.